from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
I think he treated the microphone like a good buddy.
He was hanging out with you and talking about things that he found should be important.
He knew he had a large audience, but he always made it seem like he was talking specifically to you.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Dr. James Brandon, our first guest on today's program. Dr. Brandon is chairman and professor of theater at Hillsdale College. We talked at length with Dr. Brandon about Rush Limbaugh, his life and work in radio. Dr. Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Scott.
And we are talking today about the late Rush Limbaugh. For many reasons, but specifically because both you and I have studied him and have written some things about him. I wrote recently over at National Review about the relationship that Rush had with his audience, that special relationship. I wrote a piece last year for the American Spectator, Rush Limbaugh, Exceptional American. I didn't write the headline, but it fits. A little more in-depth about the business side of things, how he sort of took advantage of the fairness doctrine being eliminated and was the first man through the door to be this talk radio star. And you actually wrote your dissertation on Rush Limbaugh. How did that come about?
Well, I did, and it came about because I was studying for my Ph.D. in theater, and I was in a contemporary theory course that was heavy on political performance artists and got the spiel at the beginning, how we were going to encounter all points of view and all, and, well, that really wasn't the case. So I decided to challenge things a bit by writing a paper about Rush Limbaugh, actually specifically about Rush Limbaugh's fans, who had created some performances and some protests that I felt followed along with what we were learning. That is, he had created, he himself was a political performance artist, and his fans had become performers. And so I ended up writing a paper that explored that, and it turned into dissertation, which was not my plan at the beginning. And but I was pleased. It was fun. And so I spent, you know, hundreds of hours with the radio show, the television show, the Limbaugh letter, all of his books, all of the books written about him, the books praising him, the books that didn't like him so much. I mean, I really was in that area for about 5 years of intense study.
What we want to talk about, I think, is sort of in two parts. One is what made him so great, what made his radio show so unique. And then also that relationship that he did have with his fans that led to that intense loyalty. And if we take that first part, you know, what made him and his show great and unique? What's your answer to that question?
I think first and foremost, Rush was a comedian. He was funny. He was someone who you could listen to and sort of, you know, he was a bit outrageous. He said things that you probably wouldn't say in your own time. But that's what comedians do. They say things that are outrageous. They say things that are a bit over the top, a lot of hyperbole and exaggeration. And Rush did that, and he did it so easily that it was easy to sort of have fun. And it was easy to feel like you were part of something beyond yourself, because he, as he often said, he just said the things that people were already thinking. And I remember reading, I think it was Camille Paglia, who was talking about Rush Limbaugh, and she said, you know, he's not this guy about hate or hate speech. She says he's a comedian. He's funny. And that makes him accessible. So I think first and foremost, audiences enjoyed spending time with Rush because he made it fun. And politics aren't always fun, especially if you're very passionate about politics, as Rush's followers certainly were. So that would be my answer, is the comedian aspect of it.
And I think he would agree, right? He gave interviews both early in his career and then later in his career where he defined himself as entertainer, businessman first, right? And he was a conservative. He was a conservative's conservative. And that's a you know, a key part of what he was and also why he was successful, you know, sort of taking advantage of the inefficiency in the business model of radio. And right. But he was an entertainer. Yeah. And he truly knew how to make an audience laugh, how to captivate an audience, that really special thing in radio that I talk about with my students here is, you know, when someone's driving home and they can't leave their car until the segment's over or until the story is over because they can't miss what you're talking about, and Rush had that in spades. I think there was a sense to outsiders over the years that what Rush did was easy, that you could bring someone else from outside the radio world and just do what Rush did. Or, as with Air America on the left, the liberals tried to start, you know, this liberal radio network with Al Franken and others, and it was not successful.
Well, he knew his stuff backwards and forwards. You know, at the time I was writing my dissertation work, I was coaching a speech program, and one of the events was extemporaneous speaking, where they would be asked questions about current events, and they would have to be able to cite research. And, you know, this was before the Internet was around, but you would still have the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was reading Newsweek and Time and U.S. News and The Nation and National Review and everything I could get my hands on in order to coach my students. And so was Rush. Rush was reading all of this stuff, plus The New York Times, plus The Wall Street Journal, and he really did his research. He knew not only what was important, but he knew how people were covering it. And he often felt that it was being covered with a slant,
mm-hmm.
and so that would give him the opportunity to correct the story, as he used to say. And so that research, that level of commitment to the information, I think, is one of the things that... But none of that matters if he can't present himself well. And he just had the knack that made him fun to listen to.
He rarely had guests on the program. He took calls sparingly, except on Open Line Friday, for many hours of the week and many hours of the month and many hours of the year. It's literally just Rush Limbaugh talking.
Yeah.
What was the secret he unlocked? How did he do that? That's tough.
I think he treated the microphone like a good buddy. You know, you're sitting talking about politics or whatever. He was hanging out with you and talking about things that he found to be important. He knew he had a large audience, but he always made it seem like he was talking specifically to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's another one of those nice things that great radio broadcasters are capable of doing. They're whispering into your ear and your ear alone. And so that was the enjoyable part, because especially, you know, when do you listen to Rush, especially if you're a career person? When you're driving,
mm-hmm.
and often when you're driving by yourself, or you're working at your desk and it happens to be on the radio. And so it really did feel like an intimate sort of setting. And that's, I think, people were craving that, particularly at that time.
Why do you think that his success was so long-lasting? 30-plus years, starting in Sacramento, to New York, and then, of course, national syndication, 600-plus radio stations. The success was not necessarily dependent on who was in office or who was out of office. The success was constant. And we do see, especially in the entertainment world, there's a time, there's an expiration date, I should say, mm-hmm. on fame, an expiration date on being successful and effective.
Mm-hmm.
But he was for this very long period of time. Why do you think that might have been?
I think he was very deft at handling the changes in his audience and in the political world. I think listening to him near the end when Trump was in power, I mean, things changed on the right, his audience changed, and he rolled with that. He didn't make strong policy stands because it was fashionable. He held on to sort of core truths, and then he applied those to whoever he was working with and whatever his audience consisted of that time. So I really think he adapted to changing circumstances all the while. You know, you could listen to Rush in 1989, and you could go back on the air in 2012,
mm-hmm.
and you're getting the same product. So there was this comfort in, oh, let's see what Rush has to say about X. And he would be saying it in the same way he said it. So it felt genuine, and it felt consistent, because his style was always the same, even though his content sort of shifted over the years.
We'll pause there, talking with Dr. James Brandon from Hillsdale College about Rush Limbaugh. When we return, a little more about Rush's bond with his audience. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We've been talking with Dr. James Brandon, Chairman and Professor of Theater at Hillsdale College, about Rush Limbaugh. Dr. Brandon wrote his dissertation on Rush. I wrote a few pieces, one last year in the American Spectator, one recently at National Review about Rush Limbaugh. And what a National Review I wrote about his deep connection, unbreakable bond, as he would say, with the audience. And this is a special part of the show, and a special part of those listeners who stuck with him for so long through the years. Why do you think there was that bond between host and listener, and what did he do to develop that?
Well, he sold the narrative that he was equal time. That is to say that the rest of the mainstream media was biased, and he was there to correct that. He was there to balance that out. And a lot of people felt that to be the case. They didn't feel like they had representation on the mainstream media. This is before even Fox News mm-hmm. became the juggernaut that it was. So there was an identity there that, yeah, that's right, nobody else is saying these sorts of things. He cultivated his audience by making them feel like they were a community, like they had something in common. One of the things I cover in my dissertation was the emergence of what were called rush rooms. Mm-hmm. You know, these places, especially in the sort of Great Lakes and Midwest, where a restaurant or a bar would have the show playing and people would gather to listen to the show. And so now you're not just listening to somebody in your car. Now you're going out with other people that are like-minded and listening to the same show, laughing at the same jokes. And he did lots of things like that, and then his audience started to create things like that that allowed them to sort of meet up with each other and enjoy Rush together, like a performance, like a theater experience, right, where you've got hundreds of people in the audience, or millions, as opposed to an individual experience listening in your car.
He won on both ends, though, because he was masterful at the one-on-one, and part of that is because intentionally or inadvertently, I think inadvertently, with the no guests and the few phone calls, it really was just him and the listener for so many hours during the week, so it was even more intimate than usual. Mm-hmm. He wins there, and then he cultivates this audience that begins to feel that they're a part of something, and they can do these things like the rush rooms or the bake sale, if mm-hmm. we want to talk about that briefly, where they come together apart from the host, but still a part of the show, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. And, you know, a lot of these things he would maybe mention, and then people would pick it up and run with it. So one of the things in my dissertation was this thing called Dan's Bake Sale, where one of his guests was complaining that his wife wouldn't let him buy a subscription to the Limbaugh Letter, his newsletter. And this was at the time when they were having these symbolic bake sales at like elementary schools, and the proceeds would go to paying off the national debt or something like
right.
that. And Rush thought these were foolish. These were sort of style over substance. But he said, you know, I'm not gonna give this to my listener. It's not an entitlement. You ought to go out and have a bake sale and earn the money in order to get my newsletter. And so of course this guy organizes a bake sale, and you know, I don't even remember the numbers anymore, but 20 or 30,000 people show up, and it becomes, like, I always say it's like Rush Limbaugh's version of Woodstock. All of these people came to celebrate the man, and while they were there, a lot of them wore costumes, and a lot of them had signs and you know, clever stuff, fun stuff, performative stuff that was very much about the politics of the day. At the same time, here's a safe audience where we can all say these things together.
Right. In his broadcast style, one of the more interesting things, if you know where to look, you can find his influences pretty clearly, I think. Paul Harvey, mm-hmm. right, for one, from sort of the pro-America, the optimist about America, to his use of pauses, which he said, you know, a little dead air never hurt anyone.
Yes.
That's very Paul Harvey-esque. You know, Muhammad Ali, I think Rush himself had talked about sort of emulating Ali's speaking style at times, and sort of the self-aggrandization at times. Larry Lujack, who is a person that many listeners might not know, but we're both Chicago area guys.
Yeah.
Larry Lujack, one of the legendary top 40 radio hosts of the 70s and into the 80s. And then William F. Buckley, of course,
right?
From both the sort of the academic bookish side of things, but also the way Buckley connected with people, having this knowledge and yet making it accessible to those who wanted to watch Firing Line and see his see his interviews. Rush took all of that and made it into his own little concoction.
No, I agreed. And I think he also, you know, I mean, if we listen to the sort of radio landscape that he grew up in, that's where like a Larry Lujack comes into play. But if we also think about the talk shows that he was running against, and a lot of them were, and this was when the shock jocks were really starting to come out, and he never really wanted to go that far, but he did do and say things that were meant to sound horrifically controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Rush would always say, look, you've got to understand the context of the show. And so he would make a comment, and if you just flipped on the radio and you heard this comment, you would, whoa, I can't believe he said that. But it would be one of those things that would come back over and over again. And so he kind of had that shock jock mentality of, I can't believe I just heard that. But for the longtime listener, no, he's been talking about this for weeks or years even, and so there's a specific context in which a phrase or a term would find itself, and very accessible. Like, you know, Buckley and his sort of his fusionist conservatism and Fireline was great, but it was very erudite. It was very not, didn't seem like it was for a normal person, a regular radio listener. And Rush was across the board. I think people that very little education and people that knew politics backwards and forwards were both fascinated by the way he talked about the topic. He was having fun, you know, and as he said, you know, even at the end, he just talked about what a great responsibility he felt and how much fun it was to do what he was doing. And his audience picked up on that. You know, if he's enjoying it, I always tell, you know, actors and speakers, if you're not enjoying it, neither is your audience. And man, he just felt like he was having a great time all of the time. And by virtue, everyone else felt like they were having a good time along with him.
It was appointment radio in the truest sense. And I've seen some of the ratings, and I can tell you, right, when noon or 11 a.m. Central, where we grew up, came, that's when radios flipped. Mm-hmm. People knew when the show started, didn't want to miss the opening monologue. I explained it in one of my pieces as like a lunch date, right? It's noon on the East Coast. It's 12:06. The show's starting. Grab something to eat, and there's an empty chair alongside, whether you're driving or at the table, and Rush is invited into your presence. And that's what the show felt like, I think, for many, many listeners.
It certainly did. And I remember, driving a lot around that time in my life and saying, you know, we'll leave around noon or 11, depending on where we were. I could, for the first 3 hours, I would at least have Rush to listen to. But yeah, I don't remember another radio show or host having that kind of power in the 80s and 90s that you would sort of set your, oh, I got to listen at noon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that was, the consistency was great. And even when he would have guests, he didn't have a lot of guests, but he would have guest broadcasters.
Sure.
And even that, they I don't think he gave them a template, but they were trying to keep the same sense. So it wasn't too strange. And but yeah, he was definitely somebody that people made time in their day to listen to.
Dr. James Brandon, chairman and professor of theater at Hillsdale College, as we talk a bit about the late Rush Limbaugh. Dr. Brandon, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, speaking of talk radio, longtime host in Seattle at KVI, Kirby Wilbur will join us. He has left Seattle and retired from the business. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency childcare, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Premier, your friendly old change. Premier in all we do.
The seasons are changing. Keeping your family healthy is important. So is the health of your car. The longevity of your vehicle depends on you to make sure your oil, radiator, coolant, windshield wipers, and other vital systems have all been taken care of so your car can bring your healthy family through the seasons. Drive into Premier Oil Change today and experience the friendly oil change. Premier doesn't require an appointment, and you don't drop your car off or wait. Premier changes your fluids while you stay in the comfort and safety of your own car. Enjoy a free beverage and free Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point certified service. Earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palo Cedro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park, or in Anderson across from Round Table Pizza. All locations, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Home of the friendly oil change.
It's never too late to achieve your dream, to turn a skill into a career. At Shasta College, we have late start classes right now and online classes where the commute from the couch to the class has never been easier. We're also offering 8-week compressed classes, same units, half the time. Now is the right time to upskill or reskill for high-demand jobs employers are hiring for. Find out more. Visit ShastaCollege.edu today.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. In response to COVID-19, NFI has scheduled online Zoom classroom sessions for CCW and CCW Renewal. These online courses will be followed up with live fire range training, which will complete your certification. Follow-on range training is done with the same great instructors you've come to know and love. Give us a call today at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
A Moment in History by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. The town of Delta was established by the California and Oregon Railroad in 1884 at the confluence of the Sacramento River and Dog Creek. Railroad officials turned the site into a temporary railhead terminal, laid out a town site, and gave it a more dignified name of Delta because of the similarities of the town site terrain and the Greek letter Delta. Reading and Shasta merchants flocked to the area to open stores, believing it would be another red-hot railhead town like Reading. Delta soon thrived, but almost disappeared as fast as it had appeared. What little remained became a stopover for steam engines to take on water for the rest of the climb through the canyon. Delta still exists today as a very small, quiet community. This moment in history was brought to you by KCNR and Shasta County historian Dottie Smith. For more stories like this, find Dottie Smith on Amazon or at the Shasta Historical Society.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the show. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Kirby Wilbur, longtime talk radio host for KVI in Seattle, a former chairman of the Washington State Republican Party, and involved in conservative circles for many years. Kirby, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, and I love Hillsdale, so happy to be here.
We actually disappointed because right around the beginning of the pandemic, we had scheduled Kirby for a visit to Hillsdale, and due to travel restrictions and other reasons around, March, April of last year, that didn't happen, so perhaps we can reschedule sometime in the future, but we are thankful to have you with us today. And two big life changes for you, Kirby. You are a longtime Washington State, Seattle area resident. That has changed as you've moved to Texas, and you've retired from the daily grind of doing the radio show, the talk radio show in Seattle. So I guess I ask first, what came first, the decision to retire or the decision to move?
Well, I think it was almost simultaneous in that my contract was up at the end of the year, and we've been thinking about moving and retiring just because everyone's career comes to an end. I'd rather be it on my terms than management dragging me out of the studio saying, you can't do this anymore, while I'm screaming, no, let me go. And so it's kind of simultaneous, and we've been to Texas and visited Texas. It appealed to us in a lot of different ways, weather, Republican governance, the spirit of Texas, the whole idea of independence and liberty, nicest people in the world. We've been there several times that we have friends down here. In fact, I know a couple of Hillsdale graduates down here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came a couple of times, found a neighborhood we liked, and decided to buy a house and sell our house in Seattle. which is at the peak of the market right now. It's a crazy market up there. And it just all kind of worked out.
So why leave Seattle? You've been there for quite a long time, certainly made your career there. The weather is a little rainy, I guess, but not too terrible in Seattle, right? So why do you decide to leave?
No, it's not. The political climate, the socialists control the Seattle City Council. I mean, actual open pronoun socialists, not Democrats, not liberals, socialists. They've been passing a lot of restrictive laws on business. They just mandated a $4 an hour minimum wage increase for workers in grocery stores, which resulted in several of the grocery stores closing. Taxes continue to go up. Property taxes continue to go up even though schools are closed and teachers aren't working in the school buildings. And the trend was worse. And we decided that our nest egg and the rest of our lives, we want to spend someplace a little different.
I was in Seattle for the first time about 3 years ago, and I had read some stories of some of the homelessness and the tent cities, and stayed in a hotel downtown, did some walking around and restaurants and such, and I was surprised that the problem seemed even deeper than I had read. I mean, that this was a real issue. What are some of the political, social factors that have led to this issue in Seattle?
Well, the lack of enforcement of laws. The city council has told the police they cannot sweep camps, clean up camps. There was a Ninth Circuit Court ruling that homeless people living in tents and elsewhere could not be forced out if they had nowhere else to go. And we've been told, the police have been told, that they can't compel people to go to shelters. And the city attorney does not back up the police to try and force these laws and try and deal with this. You have what we call a homeless industrial complex, special interest groups in Seattle that receive millions from government to help homeless programs and issues, and they make this money. They want a homeless issue. I have gone out on the streets with Union Gospel Mission, helping these people, seeing how they live. A large number of them are not from Seattle. They come here because of the lack of treatment and lack of enforcement. In fact, most of the homeless people I met were not from here. There are some hardship cases. There are some cases of people who've lost their homes or lost their jobs, but most of them have addiction issues, mental issues, and from out of town. It's like Seattle's a magnet, and nothing's being done to prevent that or deal with that, and so these camps grow.
And what about the recent destructive protests through downtown Seattle? I, in fact, recognize some of the places that I was walking in my visit to Seattle were being destroyed. The Amazon Go store was ransacked, places like that. Were those protests as bad as perhaps the pictures and videos that we saw across the country? And did that play into your decision to leave?
They were worse. And it spread to the suburbs, Bellevue, very affluent suburb of Seattle. They have a mall there called Bellevue Square. That's one of the top five profitable malls in the country. Not many malls are profitable anymore, but this one is, in large part because it offers free parking. The developer was smart looking ahead. And the Floyd riots spread into Bellevue on that weekend, that last weekend in May. And on that Saturday, they pillaged the Bell Square. The police didn't stop them because they said they didn't have the manpower. And they had videos, pictures of people streaming into the mall, walking out with shoes and jackets and clothes and jewelry. My wife, Trina, who had some questions about leaving Seattle, she was 75% committed. As we watched this on TV, said, this is it. I've had it. We're gone. Mm. When the police cannot protect an established shopping mall from pillaging and allow it to happen, it's time to go.
Kirby Wilbur is with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. You are in Texas. You've been there about 6 weeks or so. You mentioned to be off the air that in 6 weeks you already feel at home. You feel like you belong in Texas. That might be a hard thing to explain, that feeling inside, but how would you explain your new home of Texas?
Well, I would explain people are the nicest, friendliest people ever. Everyone, they ask how you are. They say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir. Very curious, very polite, just incredible people. And the feeling of freedom is, it's a different culture. A lot of churches here, a lot of guns here. People don't react adversely to that. And so if you were a person of faith, you're not mocked. Seattle has a very low rate of church attendance. And down here, it's more common. Churches in every corner. A different attitude toward guns. In Seattle, you have stores that say gun-free zones, no guns allowed, that kind of thing. Down here, a lot of businesses have, if you can legally conceal carry, you're welcome to bring your gun. You're welcome here. It's just a different atmosphere all over the place. And it's widespread, like I say, from businesses to faith to the issue of guns to politicians. Met my county sheriff. He's a sheriff. He looks like a sheriff. You know, cowboy hat, boots. And we had a nice chat about law enforcement, and everyone down here knows about Seattle because everyone has talked about Seattle, and they can't believe what goes on in Seattle. And they find it very hard to believe, and I totally understand why they find it hard to believe.
Kirby, you have left the talk radio universe, longtime KVI Seattle host, both in mornings and at afternoons. You mentioned you get to exit on your own terms, which is always a very nice thing. When you look at the industry you spent so much time in and now are departing, do you think that talk radio generally is as vibrant and as important as it was, say, 10, 15 years ago?
I do, and I think it's become very established as a means of for conservatives to communicate with each other and to communicate with the public. The mainstream media is obviously extremely biased and very left-wing. Talk radio, at least, has maintained that presence, and people know if they want a conservative opinion, they can come and hear it on talk radio. The passing of Rush is a blow, but Rush was the leader. And he has a lot of apostles, if you will, people like me who might not even be in radio had it not been for Rush breaking the barrier.
Kirby Wilbur, longtime talk show host at KVI in Seattle, former chairman of the Washington State Republican Party, now new Texas resident as he's retired from work and left the Seattle area. Kirby, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're more than welcome, and God bless Hillsdale. Let me know if I can do anything to help. I'm more than willing.
Up next, David Whalen from Hillsdale's English Department will talk about John Henry Newman and a liberal arts education. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Orchard Nutrition Center, your local neighborhood health food store. We are dedicated to the healthy lifestyle, and we strive for a high standard to carry organic, GMO-free, and clean, healthy products.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
Because you are worth it.
We have certified nutritionists on staff that take pride in helping you. Supporting local, we are all in it together. Orchard Nutrition Center, Cypress Square Shopping Center, Reading.
This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College, for prospective students, for friends of Hillsdale or alumni, go to hillsdale.edu. We're joined today by Dr. David Whalen, Associate Vice President for Curriculum and Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Whalen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
We talk about John Henry Newman. So tell us, who is John Henry Newman? What should we know about him?
Right. John Henry Newman was a 19th century clergyman, English clergyman, and what we would call professor, what in England they would call a don, a master at Oxford College. He, in the middle of his life, he became a Roman Catholic and was instrumental in founding an Irish Catholic university. And in that act gave a series of lectures that have come down to us as a very famous book pertaining to liberal education, The Idea of a University. Newman's life's work really was dedicated to preserving traditional Orthodox Christianity and advancing traditional liberal arts education.
What would you say was the state of the educational world around Newman when he was writing and thinking on the subject?
That's an important question. It was
Turtle Bay Exploration Park is back open for exploration. See the West Coast Biennial Art Exhibition featuring diverse pieces by artists up and down the West Coast. Enjoy the Visible River Aquarium, Caverns Exhibits, Parrot Playhouse, and more. There's something for everyone to discover at Turtle Bay.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of the Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at EstateGranite.com.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
From the Pacific Justice Institute, this is The Legal Edge.
California State Senator Brian Jones recently introduced the Religion is Essential Act. For future emergencies, this bill will protect religious organizations from discrimination and any health, safety, and occupancy requirements that will impose a substantial burden on a religious service.
Learn more about our ministry and get exclusive email updates by registering for The Legal Insider at pji.org.
Turtle Bay Annual Auction is going virtual. Now everyone can take part in bidding on exciting items and supporting Turtle Bay. Bidding begins March 11th. Tune in for the live virtual watch party March 20th on Facebook Live or YouTube. Go to turtlebay.org and click the online auction banner to register and learn more.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Redding area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
The world is full of obvious things which nobody, by any chance, ever observes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Before we get started on today's episode, we want your questions. Every December, we talk about specific questions that we receive from you so we can answer them and make sure that we're addressing your specific needs. So if you have a question, contact us, let us know what it is, so we can answer it for you.
There are a couple ways to do that. You can either find us on Facebook, send us a message that way, or of course, the email address at the end of this episode is a great way to contact not only your questions, but episode ideas and commentary about how fantastic my voice is.
So let's get into today's episode. What's the topic?
We are talking about using your senses, not just what I see or what I hear, but what I'm tasting, what I'm smelling. This is a common bit of advice you hear from third grade teachers. Make sure you include all five senses in the scene.
The reason why senses are so important is that it immerses the reader into the moment with something that they can connect with that otherwise they wouldn't understand. while most of your readers may not know what, say, a homeless person who lives on the streets most of the time and never gets a shower smells like, you do know what a boy's gym locker room smells like after a day of football practice. These are small little details that you can connect the dots to give them an idea of the senses of what they're seeing, hearing, tasting, because readers want to be in the moment. They want to be in the world, and the senses is how you do that.
Not necessarily strictly smells, although that is a great one to give an idea of environment. But if your character can taste the rain in the air before the storm, that's something your readers can relate to.
So we mentioned earlier the five senses. We're aware that that's probably what you've been taught. That's what we were taught. That's what we were familiar with. But there are so many more senses than just five.
In this particular case, we're talking about ways that we interact with the world, ways that the world gives our brains information. Not necessarily seeing dead people like the sixth sense or an emotional IQ, these other things that are part of the human experience, but literally how you get information from the world.
Physical interactions. The most common that you're going to be using in a book is vision, what they're seeing.
And this tends to be the default for a lot of storytellers, because a lot of storytellers also watch TV, also go to the movie theaters. You see and you hear a lot of things in cinema, and therefore when you're seeing the story play out in your head, it's sight and sound based often.
So that's the second sense, is the hearing. Your third is smell. This can be so important, because people remember smells really well. There are actually studies linking smell with memory. So if you can introduce them to a smell that they are familiar with, you are connecting them with a story on a new level.
Smell is closely intertwined with taste. They're right next to each other on the face, yes, but a lot of the words you're going to use are very similar. That saltiness, that nuttiness. Talk about tea tasting or wine tasting. They will say a perfuminess to the flavor, the bouquet of the wine.
Speaking as someone who has a lot of allergies that affect my sinuses, your smell affects your taste. If I can't smell anything, I really can't taste much. It has to be a very strong flavor for me to taste it.
This particular list has 9 different kinds. We got that list from TalkingMatters.com. And what we in kindergarten learned as touch is not only texture, something is soft or silky, but also temperature, something is hot or cold, but also pain.
Which also goes with hot and cold, because a lot of pain is associated either with hot or with cold.
Those are all kind of in the touch category, but I wanted to make sure we talked about each of these separately because there are different ways for your character to interpret their environment. It is not only cold, but it is sharp.
You can also have balance as one of the senses. This is really important for characters who, I don't know, maybe are drunk, maybe got drugged, who are usually very graceful and suddenly find themselves tipping and unable to stand up straight.
Also, if your character has a motion sickness or, you know, is on a pirate ship, that sense of balance, especially if it's their first time, takes a little while to get your sea legs.
And then the flip side, get used to land after having sea legs.
And the last sense we're going to talk about kind of goes with balance, and that is proprioception, which is more or less your coordination, your hand-eye coordination.
It's awareness of your body, where it is in relation to things around you.
So I just wrote a scene where a character had a dagger pointed at her kidney. She could guess by his voice how far away his head was, therefore how long the weapon was. So without even looking, she knew where his wrist was, where his elbow, his shoulder. So she could disarm him without looking. That's a great proprioceptive ability and awareness of not only her body, but others around her.
So I want you, our listeners, to think about your main character. what is your main character sensing that you aren't writing into the story? What can you add that will add to the story?
One of the ways that I have dabbled with this in the past is by creating a character who is missing one of these. I have created blind characters just to see if I could get the reader to envision the scene without any sight-based elements around them.
So while you're thinking about your character, what they can use, what may help to remove from them, we want you to follow one rule. Do not use all of the senses at the same time.
Think about your human experience. How often are you aware of all five senses at once, or all nine senses at once?
Most of these are instinctual. Your proprioception especially, your balance, these are instinct. And the only time you notice it is if something is wrong.
And if your character isn't noticing it, then really your reader probably shouldn't be either. That especially is the case for deep POV writers. So somebody who's writing kind of like for first or third person from the character's point of view. If you're writing from an omniscient point of view, it's a little more fluid because you want the reader to be another observer in the story instead of feel like a main character.
So what are the senses good for in writing? What are they used for other than just to give a reader a way to connect?
Understanding these senses and how your character reacts to these senses informs us about the character. Is that smell of chewing gum saccharine, that sickly sweet, or is it nostalgic? Both of those are very different from each other, but they inform about the character who's interpreting that smell.
It can also be used to set a scene. So you have your character noticing the weather, noticing whether it's light or dark outside, noticing what they can see and hear. When you dig deeper into the other senses, then we really get a feel of that scene.
If your character is stepping into an abandoned house for the first time, that musty smell that's a little bit moist, a little bit almost sweet, a little bit nutty.
Very stale.
I don't have to visually describe the corners of the room to give you an idea of being there, what it's like. If you are setting a scene, you are in cinema, it's called a wide shot. If you are establishing everything that's happening in the moment, using your five senses more than just sight is incredibly helpful.
But again, be careful about using all of them at the same time. Go piece by piece. What do they notice first? What would your character notice first? Would it be the smells? Would it be the sights? And then as you get into the scene, separate it a little bit, get into those further details with the other senses.
And of course, just like those undefinable emotions that we spoke about a week ago, all of those undefinable scents and flavors, similes and metaphors are your friend. She smelled like a warm summer's day. I don't really know what a warm summer's day smells like, but there's an emotion and attachment to that particular scent.
The biggest takeaway from today's episode is consider more. What else does your character experience that will help the reader connect with that character? That is the trick of the trade, getting your readers to connect.
This is really the advantage of a text-based entertainment format, of reading a story versus watching it on TV. You can bring your readers to that moment with all of these other senses. And all of that starts with
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center. The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR.